Council now come to order. It's 3:07 p.m. on April 30th. We have three bills today. The first one will be House Bill 197. Jane Pearson, you ready to help us out with this one?
Buster?
And looks like we've got almost a full contingency here with us. Are Representative Bob Booth, Representative Jay Ramirez, Representative Carl Gatto, Representative Mark Newman, and myself, Kurt Olson, and last but not least, Representative Berta Gardner. Please continue.
Representative Olson, House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Jane Pearson. I'm staff to Representative Jay Ramirez. And I'm going to define a trust for you. A trust is defined as a property interest held by one person as trustee at the request of another for the benefit of a third party. Therefore, a trust involves three elements, namely, one, a trustee who holds the trust property and is subject to equitable duties to deal with it for the benefit of another, two, a beneficiary to whom all trustees owes equitable duties to deal with the trust property for their benefit, and three, trust property that is held in trust for the beneficiary. The goal of this legislation is to make sure that the state of Alaska is one of the premier places for trusts and estates. It's important that Alaska stay competitive with other states that do not have personal income tax. A trust industry is important to the state of Alaska. It provides employment for accountants, attorneys, insurance agents, bankers, and their support staffs. There is between 30 to 70 million on deposit with Alaskan banks through the Alaska Trust Company alone. The state of Alaska also receives over $2 million in annual revenue from trusts. There are also over 1,000 out-of-state clients who have sought to do their trust in Alaska because of our unique trust laws. And Alaska has passed 15 pieces of legislation since 1997 to keep the industry vibrant and competitive. And HB 197 will accomplish the following. That shares in a professional corporation may be held by the trustees of the professional revocable trust. It expands the coverage of AS 1336-157, which allows the trustee to transfer trust assets to a similar trust. This expansion will only occur if the trust has an Alaskan trustee and the trust is its primary administration is in Alaska. It allows the Alaska trustee of a charitable trust to change percentage of the value of the trust that will be considered income whenever the trustee determines that a new percentage is necessary and prudent. It will clarify that a settlor's express intention to protect the trust assets from the beneficiary's potential future creditors is not evidence of intent to defraud. And this is probably the biggest policy question in this bill. And five, states need provisions relating to trustees, compensation, accepting or declining a trusteeship, co-trustees, vacancy, resignation removal, delivery of property by former trustee, reimbursement of expenses, and certification of the trust.
Mr. Chairman?
For the record, we've been joined by Representative Ledoux. Representative Ramirez?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I thank Jane for making an excellent presentation on House Bill 197. And the only thing that I would add, Mr. Chairman, is my friend Bob Gillum is often only associated with the Pebble Mine, but one of the other speeches that he likes to make, and he is a speechifying fella if I've ever met one, is he talks about Alaska's unique geography and his ability to manage $15 billion worth of funds on behalf of the groups that he represents, and he talks about Alaska's unique geography in relation to Pacific markets and the U.S. markets, and he goes on to talk about how he has more money under management than all the other commercial banks in the state combined, and he talks about what an underserved, an under-optimized marketplace Alaska is because of its geography in relation to the global capital markets. And I would suggest to you that House Bill 197 fits under a similar definition, which is Alaska is desperate for more capital. because capital creates economics, it creates jobs, banks with more money make Alaskan banking system better, it enhances our economy, and Alaska has less capital than likely any other state in the union. Just because we have $38 billion in our permanent fund, if you look into how much of the permanent fund resides in the state of Alaska, it is just a fraction of that $38 billion. And what House Bill 197 does is it helps to aggregate capital to the banking system and have it survive here in the state of Alaska. So this is a Judiciary Committee bill. It's a good bill because it keeps Alaska in a very elite class, competitive with just several other states. And so I would encourage the members to take a friendly posture toward the intent of House Bill 197. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you very much. We actually had conversations in my office today with some of the folks at the trust company, and thank you for your presentation too, because that actually clarified some of the things that they didn't clarify for me as well. But the one thing that I still have kind of a nagging question about is the thing that's point number three in sponsor statement about the trustee of a charitable trust can change the percentage of the value of the trust to be considered income. And I guess my real question is, if it's a charitable trust and they're using some of the income for charity, does that mean they have flexibility about what part of it remains in the trust and what part can be spent?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, I think there's some experts online, and I'd rather defer to them.
Okay.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also listen to my staff, like Representative Gardner. And they, in discussions on the bill, and Jane, if you could just clarify number four on your sponsor statement, and I don't have a problem with it, just want to learn about it.
That here.
Representative Newman, through the chair, that would be that clarifies that a settler's express intention to protect trust assets from a beneficiary's potential future creditors is not evidence of intent to defraud. This sets it clear in statute that you could set up a trust that to protect against a beneficiary's potential future creditors, not against the current creditors, but if there was something out in the future, it would not be an intent to defraud. And I think Dave Chattel is online, and he can better address that too.
Okay, if you can point that out then. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, if there are no further questions for Jane, I think we'll let's see who's online.
Mr. Chattel.
We'll go with Dave Chattel first. Dave, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Dave Chattel, and I'm one of a group of attorneys who have worked with the legislature, I guess, since about 1996, attorneys and trust officers just providing suggestions for statutes that would improve estate and trust administration in Alaska. And a number, I think, in the last hearing I participated in, somebody had kept count. I think there have been 15 statutes that have been enacted since that time that the legislature has passed and really have greatly improved our situation here in Alaska. We're one of the few areas of the law where the practitioners have been very active and have made suggestions, and the legislature has listened carefully and enacted most of them, and it's really improved our position both for residents of Alaska and also for non-residents who desire to use Alaska approaches in their estate planning. This particular bill we think is an excellent one. I don't know if Beth Chapman is there with you today. She did a lot of the initial research on this bill. It deals with a number of default provisions for trustees We haven't had those provisions in our statutes previously. So these provisions are often covered in a well-written trust document. But if you have a situation where the document has not been written well, either because an expert wasn't retained to do that drafting, or the trust may have been brought into the state of Alaska from another state, and these areas were not covered in the trust document, then these provisions pick up. That's why I say they're default provisions. They're provisions that if they aren't covered in the document itself, then these provisions come in and apply. And so they will help probably a lot of smaller trusts where the kind of expertise that's usually brought to a project has not been brought, and they should be very helpful for Alaskans who, for one reason or another, are beneficiaries of these trusts but need these additional statutory provisions so that the trust can operate successfully. That's kind of a general overview of the statute. I think it's a very good one, and urge you to give it careful consideration, and I hope you pass it. I'd be happy to answer any specific questions if I can.
Representative Liddell.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Schaftel. I'm on Section 14 right now, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to figure out through a specific kind of an example of what the law is today with respect to fraudulent transfers vis-a-vis trust agreements, and what it will be once this is passed. If you could kind of give me an example.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Ledoux. This, let me explain the background of this particular suggested provision. First, it does not deal with fraudulent transfers. If a transfer is fraudulent to a trust or another vehicle, that transfer will be set aside. This one is more designed to address what's called asset protection planning, which is not fraudulent but is done well in advance of anyone having a creditor problem. And Alaska has taken a positive stance, as many states have, towards providing guidance and statutes which support asset protection planning. The problem that this particular phrase is intended to address is where arguments have been made in several cases where they say, well, if we find any evidence at all in the attorney's records or the client's records that indicate that they wanted to do asset protection planning, then that planning should be considered inappropriate and not effective. Now, that's never been the law, but it's come. That argument has been addressed in a couple of cases. We had one case where it was an unpublished opinion by the circuit court, but it seemed to follow that, you know, pick up and follow that kind of reasoning, even though the facts were horrible in that case, and they justified finding that it was a fraudulent transfer and set aside for. So to summarize, when a client comes in, when my clients come in and talk to me about estate planning, they almost always also talk to me about asset protection planning. They may want to set up a corporation for their business for asset protection purposes, so they're not personally liable. They may want to set up a limited liability company for their business, again, so that only the assets of that company are liable and they aren't personally liable. They may want to set up trusts for their children and make gifts to those trusts, and they may want to make sure that those assets are protected if their children divorce, or if they, the people who set up the trust, have financial difficulties down the line. So asset protection is almost always discussed and is one of the primary purposes of estate planning, along with saving taxes and managing assets and making sure that those assets go where they're supposed to go at a particular event, which may be the death of the person who set up the trust. All this particular provision does is to make it clear that the state of Alaska does not think that asset protection planning in itself, not fraudulent transfer planning, is not inappropriate, and that's to respond to these couple of cases where dicta was raised as to this argument when it was made by a creditor. So that's kind of a long-winded explanation, but that's what it's all about.
Representative Ledoux, do you have a follow-up or request for clarification?
Yes. I was just trying to hope for I really didn't follow all of that. And maybe if I was a trust attorney, I would have understood exactly what you meant. But I'm not, so I don't. I kind of want an example. Give me an example of of what the law is now, an example of where somebody has engaged in what you term asset protection, and then whatever the dicta was in the court which has made you concerned that this isn't going to work, and how it will work now if this section goes into effect.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, let me give you an example. You come into my office and you say, Dave, I want you to set up some trusts for my kids. And here's why. I want to put some assets in there, and I want to make sure that those assets get to my kids, and that if I have a bad situation in my law practice down the line and I get sued for malpractice, that my creditors can't reach these assets that I've put in there now for my kids. I don't have any problems right now, Dave. There are no judgments against me. Nobody has filed any claims against me. As far as I know, I've never done anything wrong that would result in that kind of a judgment. But I want to make sure that that's the case. So I write down in my file that Representative Ledoux has come in for estate planning, and that we've talked about asset protection planning. We've talked about providing money and trust so that her children can go to college. And I have those notes in my file. Now, down the line, 10 years from now, you get sued, and there's a big judgment. Maybe it's out of your law practice. Maybe it's because you were negligent in driving your car, and there's a big judgment against you. And that creditor says, I want to get at those children's trusts. I want the money in there. And there's discovery, and that creditor gets a hold of my notes, and it says, look, right there, 10 years ago, Representative Ledoux said to Dave Shaftel that she wanted to do some asset protection planning. That, I argue to you, Judge, is an intent to defraud. Now, stopping right there, that's not the law that I know of anywhere, except it has been argued, and as I say, it did appear in one circuit court case. And so Alaska, being a state which has taken a positive and strong position towards allowing asset protection planning, this would help in our statutes to make it clear. It's not a fraudulent transfer situation, but if the fact that the settlor, and that's Representative Ledoux in my example, had an expressed intention to protect trust assets from potential future creditors is not evidence of an intent to defraud.
Follow?
In your example, how could somebody get into the attorney's file like that? Wouldn't that be protected under attorney-client privilege?
If you were forced into bankruptcy, the bankruptcy trustee steps into your shoes, and in those situations, they make the argument that the privilege doesn't apply.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. I had similar problem understanding this paragraph, and I think you've gone a long way to helping me. But you did clarify and make a very significant distinction that said you had never done anything wrong. But suppose you have a traffic accident which has nothing to do with your assets after you've already given them away. Could that person who suffered harm, according to this, would not be able to come back and attach the grandchildren's trust fund? Am I correct?
Well, in the area of that we're talking about here, creditors' rights, and every state has what's called a fraudulent transfer statute, as we have here. And there's always an issue as to who is a future creditor, and how far down the line future creditors have some type of rights, and if they're anticipatable near future creditors, then in some case law allows them to have those types of rights. And in Alaska, there's a 4-year limitations period that relates to future creditors. So you could get into a situation where, let me back up a little bit. Normally, what we're talking about, and I want to make sure I'm addressing exactly your question, but if there is in a traffic accident, it's not anticipatable, and you're right, there should not be, in that situation, a successful argument on the part of a creditor that they could get at those assets. And if I included the traffic accident in my example, that is not as good an example as the malpractice situation or a business situation where future creditors are somewhat anticipatable, and that's where the courts sometimes have moved. Have I answered or addressed your question well enough? And if not, please tell me where I can help.
Well, it looks like you've satisfied Representative Gatto, but Representative Ledoux has another question.
What about a child support situation where perhaps at the time that you've made the transfer, you don't necessarily know if you're a guy that you have a child, and then there's a claim for child support somewheres down the line?
Well, of course, we're broadening this. I mean, Representative Ledoux, through the chair, it would depend on the facts of that situation. In some, if you had set up an irrevocable trust well before, now again, the question is there an intent to evade creditors? If you didn't even know you had a child at that point, and you had set up an irrevocable trust, let's say, for other children, it may be that new child for child support purposes could not reach those assets. That is regardless of what this provision we're talking about here is. Just general law.
Paula?
Yeah, I suppose I've got a problem with that.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. On that point, am I correct in understanding that what this particular provision we've been talking about addresses is the issue of whether it's fraudulent or not?
That's right.
It doesn't mean that, it doesn't say anything about whether or not the trust can be overturned, opened up, or whatever, simply that setting it up wasn't fraudulent.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's absolutely correct.
Thank you.
And maybe a better answer to Representative Ledoux's question immediately before is, if there are facts that show that it was a fraudulent transfer, then under our fraudulent transfer statute, that transfer can be attacked if there are other facts. All we're talking about here is the mere fact that asset protection was discussed at the time that the transfer occurred. That mere fact is not enough in itself to establish that it's a fraudulent transfer.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Dave.
I guess you're either Dave or I just had a question on Section 5. But
let's give it to Steve then. Steve Greer, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Can you please state your name and affiliation?
My name is Steve Greer, and I'm one of the practitioners that Dave has referred to. that's been a part of in drafting this legislation. I would like to know if, for instance, if Beth Chapman is there in presence, she was primarily responsible for this bill. Is she not there?
She is. She signed up for questions only, but she is present.
Yeah, okay. I will answer the questions, you know, any questions that you might have to the extent possible. I would like to add that this has gone through a lot of discussion over the past probably 6 or 7 months among our group, and we think that this is good legislation, and it's default legislation. Quite frankly, it articulates the law as we have, most of us have understood it to be, but it puts it into statutory form. Are there any questions you would like to ask?
Yeah, we have at least one. Representative Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can ask either Beth or Mark. I guess we're here now. On Section 5, where it talks about compensation, when I read that section, it pretty much says that whatever the trustee charges and it's agreed on to, that is considered to be appropriate. And if there's ever a question, then it's up to the person who the trustee or the interested person in a review of the compensation has to prove the burden of the other way around. I was just wondering about compensation. Is compensation generally, how is that handled? And I'm certainly a believer in a free enterprise system and competition. And is that generally how it's done?
Representative Newman, through the chair, it's been my practice to state that a trustee is entitled to reasonable compensation and not to get into definite language as to what's reasonable. Oftentimes we draft these trusts and they don't come into fruition until, you know, 30 or 40 years later. And, you know, it's hard to specify what might be reasonable that far out in the future. Under today's terms, how I always like to address this when people ask the question is that a person who performs services is entitled to reasonable compensation, and the best way to find out what might be reasonable is to ask what the local banks charge for similar services. And the court has a standard too, by the way. We know if we go down to the probate court will say, does this trustee have any special expertise? If so, there's a certain hourly rate that they allow. If they don't have any special expertise, then there's another hourly rate that they will allow. I hope that answers your question.
I think so.
Any further questions? We have two people that were signed up, questions only. If either one of them would care to make a statement at this time, they can, or if they choose not to, we'll come back into the room. And I guess we'll start with Beth.
Richard Thwaites.
Oh. Go ahead, Richard. Please state your name and affiliation.
I'm a private practitioner with the group. I kind of was involved in the early start of all of this stuff and have subsequently also become affiliated with Alaska Trust Company. My early years in the trust business with First National and then later as a private attorney, sometimes you would end up with a trust out there that someone had drafted on their own, and it was a fully legal document, just that I leave everything in trust, period. And this whole bill kind of goes to that issue. With regard to compensation, what I had to do in one of those cases early on in my career was go to court, because the Superior Court Probate Division retains jurisdiction over trusts, and we literally had to go through and create all of these sorts of things for that trust. Currently, the court still does that. The court still retains that jurisdiction. If a beneficiary chooses to challenge the reasonableness of the fees, even though the fees are set forth in a schedule, those fees can be challenged at that level, and the court will render a decision as to whether they were reasonable or not. Sometimes, in one or two cases, the fees actually go up because of an extraordinarily aggressive and involved beneficiary increasing the costs of the administration of the trust. That's pretty rare, but it still could happen.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anybody else online that would care to testify?
This is Douglas Blottmacher.
Good afternoon, Doug. Could you please state your name and affiliation?
My name is Douglas Blotmacher, and I'm president of Alaska Trust Company. And we'd just like to state that, you know, we've been working with the Bar Association for years trying to strengthen Alaska's trust and estate laws, and I just strongly support this. And if you have any questions, but just we support this legislation.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think at this point in time, we'll again go to Beth Chapman. Beth,
thank you.
Please state your name and affiliation.
I'm Beth Chapman, and I'm an attorney that practices here in Juneau. And I also have been working on this bill for the last year and a half, and I wanted to address the question that, Representative Gardner asked regarding the charitable trust in Section 12. And the reason for this change is that a few years ago, there was a change in the law as to how trusts and particular charitable trusts were invested. And under the old law, you would invest for income only, which is what would be given to the charities, but that limited the ability to grow the fund, because if you invest for income, you don't invest for growth. With the change a few years ago to allow trusts to be invested for both income and for growth, charitable trusts were sort of restricted. And this allows the charitable trustees to now change the percentage. Instead of just distributing income, distribute a percentage of the trust every year, which will generate more revenues to the charities and at the same time allow them to preserve the fund for the long term.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any, you know, we keep hearing from the people that are writing trusts and involved in trusts and making money off of trusts. I'm dying to hear from somebody who opposes this, who would say, the issues I have are, and I haven't heard that, and I'm just a little nervous, because I see some rather dramatic language change in here, especially on page 12, where there's this addition.
Through the chair, what part of page 12?
It's page 12. It's the new language on 13, 14, and 15. And I have so much trouble understanding that sentence that I go over it and over it, and I say, I think I got it, but I'm cautious.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, you're talking about the sentence in Section 14 that was discussed earlier about
right,
the settlers' expressed
language.
Intention.
Right.
The reason for the sentence was that asset protection has been done for years and years, and it's done by everybody. Anybody that writes a will that leaves assets to their children, they usually use a trust. That's asset protection. They're trying to protect it from the child's creditors to make sure it's going to be there for the long term. When we set up a corporation, that's asset protection. Last year, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals came out with a decision.
And we always like those.
Yeah, in which they, in dicta, indicated that if in the attorney's file there was an expressed intent that there would be asset protection, that would be could in fact be an intent to defraud a creditor. Under the laws that exist now, you can't intend to defraud a creditor if you don't know about the creditor. And when we do asset protection, it's not done to avoid current creditors. In fact, none of us would do that, and in most cases, affidavits have to be signed that in fact there is no current creditors and that people have enough assets to continue to pay their bills and liabilities. The decision from the Ninth Circuit was really, as always, bad facts. Somebody had set up a trust, transferred all of their assets into it, corporations, there were shells, knowing that they were, in fact, trying to avoid potential creditors. This language is designed to override that dicta in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, and that is its primary purpose, not to change the law, which has always been the same, which is that if there's a fraudulent conveyance, it will be set aside.
And Mr. Chair, if I can continue.
Follow.
It's just I'm trying to think of trickery. If indeed I'm not indicted, but boy, I know I'm going to be indicted because I've been caught red-handed, and I now transfer assets to all my grandchildren and gosh knows who. I've not been indicted yet. Now, when I get indicted, they're going to say, I know what he did. Before he was indicted, he kind of knew it was going to happen. So he transferred assets to everybody and his uncle besides to avoid having them attached.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does this language allow me to do that?
No, it would not. If you had the intent to creditors that you knew or were likely to appear under our state laws, that would not allow you to avoid those creditors. There is a statute of limitation. There's a period of time in which if somebody comes up and after you have set up a trust and tries to undo it, they would still have that option, and the facts and circumstances would still be considered by the court.
Representative Ledoux.
So how would this apply to the RICO laws?
Federal RICO laws?
Yeah, federal RICO laws. Which, of course, I think take a conviction in order to actually seize one's assets.
I don't think this would have any effect on that law. This is state law that if somebody is coming to the Alaska court to try to set aside a transfer to a trust, it would be what, under the facts and circumstances, was there any intent to defraud a creditor? And the mere fact of asset protection, which we do every day in our law practices, whether we're a trust and estates attorneys or corporate attorneys, that in and of itself is not going to be an intent to defraud, but all other facts and circumstances would be considered by the court.
Thanks.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Beth, I'm trying to get my arms around what it costs to manage a trust. And in Section 12, it states that the language is changed. And now the trustee may change the percentage whenever the trustee determines. And a little bit before that sentence, it talks about the value or a percentage of between 2 and 7%. I would think that if you had the opportunity to charge 7%, you probably would. And then under Section 5, it says that can't be challenged then.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, Section 12 does not, the percentages have nothing to do with compensation.
Okay.
This has to do with the amount of money that will be paid out to the charities every year.
Okay.
Section 5 is the compensation schedule. And in that provision, it's not what the trustee says is reasonable. It's what the person who established the trust said. For example, I have clients who want to pay maybe their niece or nephew is going to be the trustee, and they want to pay $1,000 a month. If the parent who set up the trust says $1,000 a month is what they think is reasonable, then that's going to be deemed reasonable unless there's clear and convincing evidence that it's not.
That helps. Thank you. Then, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Beth. Just so I understand Section 12 a little bit better, then, could you just briefly explain what that means, how that works?
Through the chair, Section 12 is addressing charitable trusts. This is a trust that is set up solely to benefit charities. Mm-hmm. And under the current law, many trusts were written to pay out only income, you know, dividends, interest earned on a bank account. And charities don't like that because they don't get very much money. And so trustees are trying to balance long-term preservation of a trust fund for the benefit of charities and yet generate income or revenues to pay out to those charities every year. This gives the trustees the flexibility to move from an income standard to a percentage standard so that they could pay out, for example, an average amount of 5% of the value of the trust every year to the charities. Trustees will look at, is that percentage going to be enough to benefit the charities, but at the same time ensure that we're growing the fund for the future, which of course then if the fund gets larger, 5% is going to be more of the fund that will come out every year to charities.
Certainly sounds like a good idea to me. One more question.
Sure.
Is Beth, when was this original language or put into law? When did this become I know we're changing it now, but when did it become law and who did it?
Through the chair, Section 12, I believe, is the Uniform Principal and Income Act. Mr. Schaftel was principally involved in that, and I'm going to say it was 2000 But I could be off a little bit on that date. And the really only change that's occurring here is removing a 10-year limitation, which we have no idea why it was put into the statute. It's not in any other state statute. Thank you. And it causes potential problems. I'm sorry, it's 2003. It was initially passed. And this came to my attention when I was representing a charitable trust that needed to make a change because the charities were asking for more funds, and we realized we had this 10-year limitation. I researched all state laws, and we have no idea why it was there, and the legislative history doesn't tell us.
And, Mr. Chair, Beth, I guess trust laws, the basic bulk of this whole bill, when was that enacted in this?
Through the chair, the bulk of this bill is new.
It is,
and the bulk of it is, as everybody has already said, is to put default provisions in for folks who have trusts written that don't have these provisions. Currently, we have to go to court. We have to ask the judge to put these all in. A well-written trust will have them, but trusts that aren't, some people write their own trusts, or they write their own wills. This will then allow us to use the statute and avoid going to court.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, I think we'll close it out to public testimony and bring it back to the committee. What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chair, first I'd like to state that it seems like a lot of work went into this, and in that work being trying to clarify what we've already got so that everybody's playing by the same rules. Seems to be good legislation, and from what I hear or understand, I don't know that much about it, but if you're willing to accept a motion, maybe
make a comment first.
Certainly, Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some time back, I was dealing with a stockbroker, and I learned that stockbrokers have meetings all the time, once a week, maybe several times a week, and they have charts on the board about which stockbroker, and this is the major company, which stockbroker made the most money. They never once had a meeting that said which client did the best. They're very worried about the stockbrokers. I just am so uneasy with this. Who has been meeting? Has it ever been beneficiaries? Have there ever been trustees meet, but whether the people they deal with meet with them to determine the content of this legislation? And I want to hear from some other person besides the people who essentially benefit from the bill.
Representative Ramerson, and then Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To respond to Representative Gatto's thoughtful concern, I think that the trust, the attorneys that comprise the trust community, came together and worked on this bill in order to make Alaska a better place to manage and leave our capital. And this is really a cornerstone of, you know, what I have found to be a part of my own personal mission here to Juneau, which is that economies, and Alaska's is woefully deficient in many, many ways, are built up with capital. Alaska would surely be a stronger place if more of its $38 billion of permanent fund value was here in the state. So anytime I have the opportunity to anchor down or participate in keeping trustees, capital, for Alaska to attract the permanence of these capital pillar stones, I feel like I'm doing work to help build the infrastructure that leads to a stronger, healthier, more vibrant economy in Alaska. And I think that is what House Bill 197 satisfies, is we want to have a competitive environment. We do not want trusts that are set up under the state of Washington law or the state of Delaware law, because ultimately these cases that end up in court would be handled by the prevailing state court. And if Alaska statute is more clearly defined and there are brighter lines, then it allows for trusts to be established and trustees to move more comfortably through the process here in Alaska, guaranteeing the rights of the trust, the trustee, the settlor, all the parties. And so in this particular case, I think that the trust community is looking out for the relationship. And if the document becomes the pipeline, since we're doing it's a welcome analogy, since we're working with pipelines right now, and on one end of the pipeline you have the value, and on the other end of the pipeline you have the monetized value of the resource, because we talk about returns and dollars being returned to charitable trusts or to beneficiaries throughout this. I really think that this is a document that clarifies and makes kosher the relationship between the trustee and the beneficiary, and that in this case this collection of trust attorneys are looking out for both ends of the transaction and trying to keep a very clean relationship between both of those parties. So that's how I perceive House Bill 197.
Representative Bill?
You know, I'm also a little bit uncomfortable with this bill, simply because we've only heard from the trust bar, and it seems as if the trust bar represents those people who are trying to transfer property into trust. I guess I'd feel a little bit more comfortable if we heard from a combination of the creditor's bankruptcy bar, and I'd really be kind of curious. We keep hearing about this Ninth Circuit case in which they said something in dicta, and that seems to be kind of the impetus for at least part of this bill. I'd kind of like to hear from the attorneys in this Ninth Circuit case, although I suspect that they probably aren't even aware that we're hearing this bill.
Well, the bill has been out since March 14th, and to the best of my knowledge, we've had nobody contact the office with anything other than positive issues. I would have to think that the bar would be following any bill related to this type of activity, wouldn't they?
I think that's kind of a big assumption. I mean, first of all, the Ninth Circuit, the attorneys that we're talking about may not even be here in Alaska. And then for the regular guys who don't have lobbyists, I mean, it's the lobbyists who track bills. And so if you don't have a lobbyist down here, you're probably not tracking a bill.
Any further comments?
Yes, please.
Representative Ramos.
Yes, could we have Beth Chapman come back up, please?
Sure.
Representative Olson, if I may address the comments. First of all, I want to point out that my law firm is a full-service law firm, and we represent major corporations as well as individuals, and I practice primarily in the trust and estates area. On the asset protection area, I think the reason that there is not any objection to it is because we're not doing anything that's not already in existing law. It's just clarifying what it means to have an intent to defraud. If there is a fraudulent conveyance, that can be brought forward, and there's nothing in this bill that would prevent somebody from bringing the same arguments that they would have brought from before. Instead, it's addressing the term asset protection in and of itself, which is used by everybody. Lawyers, they're professional corporations, they're limited liability companies. That's asset protection. So it's really not changing that at all. I think that the reason, again, I think there's no objection is because there's not anything in here that is saying that a creditor does not have the rights that they currently have under state law. It's just a clarification. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision is out of the state of Washington. not out of the state of Alaska. And also, through the chair, if I may also address Representative Gatto's comments about why we don't hear any objections. I represent beneficiaries, many of them, and I represent families. I very rarely, if ever, represent a corporate trustee. And we have used these laws to save our clients significant amount of attorney's fees. Before we had adopted laws that allowed us to have default provisions or to modify trusts, we would spend significant amounts of money going to court. And now we are able to use these laws to help families take care of their children. I work a lot in the area of disability trusts, and we have used these provisions to really help beneficiaries and help families. And I don't believe, and in fact in my practice I would say I'm in court now a lot less than I used to be, and I'm very thankful for that, because I think it benefits Alaskans and allows families to take care of their children and loved ones. Thank you.
Any further questions or comments? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion to move House Bill 197, version LS0444/E, echo from committee with any attached fiscal notes or individual recommendation.
Is there any opposition? Seeing none, it moves out of committee. Brief of these while the documents are signed. We're back on the record, and the next item on the agenda is the committee substitute for House Concurrent Resolution 8, which happens to be mine, so I think I'll just address it from here. But before we do that, could I adopt the CS or have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I adopt CS for House Concurrent Resolution Number 8, Labor and Commerce Version 25LS0859/M. For committee discussion, make a motion to adopt.
Is there any opposition? On February 22nd, the RCA transmitted to the governor a number of proposed changes to the their governing statutes. The letter enclosed ended with the suggestion that the governor seek legislative determination for the appropriate salaries of the commissioners. Committee substitute for HCR 8 will set up a legislative task force to work during this interim to review the salaries of the commissioners. It will also recommend job descriptions for the commissioners and consider additional staffing and possible need for additional staff support for the RCA. The task force will consist of 9 members, 3 from the Senate, 2 majority, 1 minority, 3 from the House, 2 majority, 1 minority. The governor or her designee, the attorney general or his designee, Commissioner Noddy or his designee. The task force is set to meet during the interim and report back to the legislature at the beginning of next session, and it will sunset on May 30th of 2008. With that, do we have anybody signed up? We've got Christy Caitlin from AT&T. Are you with us, Christy?
Yes, Chairman. This is Christy Caitlin with AT&T Alascom. I'm going to be very, very brief. I just want to register my support for the task force. We, of course, would have liked to have seen some of these issues resolved this session, but in the alternative, I think that the task force is a good idea. So we are supporting that.
Oh, thank you. Is there anybody else online that would care to testify? With that, we'll come back into the room. Do we have anybody in the committee room that would care to testify on this resolution? Well, with that, we'll this will be a quick one. We'll close this out to public testimony and bring it back to the my fellow committee members. Representative Ledoux. Nope.
Just going to move the bill.
Oh, okay. Well,
Chair. Oh, that's not going to pass.
Representative Ledoux.
I move CS for House Concurrent Resolution Number 8, 25LS0859/M Kane, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
I see no opposition, and with that, we'll take a brief at ease and sign the paperwork. You wake up.
Congress says I don't think so.
We're back on the record, and with us, we have Kelly Huber from Representative Dahlstrom's office, who'll be carrying the bill this afternoon. We have a committee substitute, but before we adopt it, I think Kelly would like to explain the changes to the CS. So, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kelly Huber, staff to represent Dahlstrom. On Friday, the committee was kind enough to bring this bill before them and listen to public testimony, both in favor and in opposition. And one of the things that concerned the sponsor was that there was some confusion on whether or not this was a mandatory bill. And Legislative Legal drafted it and didn't believe that the language in it made this mandatory. But obviously there was a little bit of concern. So what she wanted to do today was bring forward the CS that is hopefully before you and let you look at page 3, section E, which is on line 24. That is a rewrite by Ledge Legal over the weekend that specifically clarifies that this would not be mandatory. And the sponsor of the bill believes it's okay in the first form, but because there was concerns before you the other day, thought that if the committee would like to clarify that this language be brought forward to you in a CS.
What line is it?
Line 24, page 3.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Part 2.
So this states that a qualifying medical exam is not needed. We have presumptive coverage, but a pre-qualifying exam is not needed?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, what this says is a municipality does not have to give the pre-qualifying exam. And in order to get the presumptive, you'd have to have the exam. So if a municipality decides that they're not going to just have their fire department, not everybody, take the pre-qualifying exam, then nobody's going to be covered. So,
Representative Ledoux.
Doesn't that gut the whole bill?
Through the chair, it really, if you look at the original language, the department already had to determine to give the qualifying exams. The municipality or the department of the governing entity already had to in some respects. So,
follow up.
Well, I mean, I'm looking here at this letter from the municipality of Anchorage, that basically says that Western civilization as we know it will fall apart if this bill is passed, which suggests to me that the municipality of Anchorage isn't on the same page and probably won't give the exams if they want to opt out of this bill, and that's where most of the if we do this, it sounds nice, but what are we really doing?
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Suppose I'm an incoming firefighter.
Mm-hmm.
Can I not? I mean, somebody in the fire department tells me, oh, by the way, if you want presumptive coverage, you've got to have an exam. Can't I go do it myself?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, we actually discussed that. And I will tell you right now, Legislative Legal would tell you that it would not be allowed under this language. That under their understanding of the bill, they would say, that was my understanding too. I actually originally thought, well, then a firefighter could take away the cost of that the city had. You know, that the city is always concerned about this exorbitant cost of these exams. So then I also wondered, well, if a firefighter could go and get their own and then bring it forward, as long as they met that 7 years and within the 5 years of retirement, you know, and all the other qualifications. But Legislative Legal advised me that they did not believe it would be interpreted that way.
In that case, I'm with Representative Ledoux. Why pass the bill?
And the sponsor wanted to bring it forward, but she likes the original bill as well.
Representative Gatto, and then Ledoux.
The Anchorage Fire Department has a required annual exam.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get out of it.
Right.
You better not get out of it. And so wouldn't that count?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, they do have an annual exam, and we have some firefighters online for questions only if you want to talk to them about it, but I know that you're familiar with it. The deal, though, the qualifying exam in this is going to be determined by regulations, so we'll have to see what the department does with that exam and the qualifications that you have to meet. I think if they are, you're right, if they're in line, then that exam is going to meet that criteria. Until we have, until the regs are written, we're not going to know.
Representative Ledoux and then Representative Newman.
Okay, I'm trying to determine where in the original bill it would talk about. And the original bill, which is page 3, department?
Line 18.
3, line 18.
You can actually, I'm sorry, you can actually go in the CS as well, because the language wasn't changed. So which one do you have, the CS or the regular bill?
I'm looking at both of them, actually.
Okay, well, look at the, if you look at page 3 of the new draft, line 18, it says, personnel who were given a qualifying medical exam.
Yes.
That's the old one, isn't it?
That's the same language, though. So the idea then is, therefore, somebody would have had to okay the exam. So therefore, the municipality or the governing entity would have had to approve it. And so that's how Ledge Legal is reading this.
So that's even in the old, when you say the sponsor prefers the old version, well, I don't think anybody picked up on this last week, but I mean, even in the old version, nobody's going to be required to do anything.
That's correct, through the chair. This would be the way it is written, whether you want the very clear language or you want the original version. The bottom line is that the city or the governing entity or the fire department, whoever's going to have control of that, will determine whether or not they want their personnel included under the presumptive clause.
Followed.
What would the sponsor think of simply a conceptual amendment deleting both in the, if we end up adopting this work draft or in the original bill, taking that out?
Through the chair, we'd have to make sure we're leaving in the exam part, but if through conceptual amendments, so that we could move the bill onto the next committee, we could get it to where we would let it be the committee's decision at that point. The next committee of referral, just so you know, the chairman sits on your committee as well.
Representative Newman and then Representative Gatto.
Thank
you.
He's
sitting next to me, I believe.
So I think what the CS does, though, is I think Representative Dahlstrom wanted to try and get some uniformity in it all so that all departments are working under the same guidelines. Is that kind of...
Through the chair, what we heard through the testimony was that there was a lot of confusion on whether or not this bill was going to be mandatory. And so if the desire of the committee is to have it, you know, very clear, the language comes before you. It will already be... the determination of the cities or whatnot if they participate, no matter which one you use. It was there, but there was some testimony before you that made it very uncertain, and we didn't want to mislead the committee, and we wanted to make sure that they knew where the bill stood.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may
follow
up. Now I'm getting two mixed signals here, and you just said that, or what I believe you've been saying is that the sponsor, Representative Dahlstrom, came up with a CS to make sure things that were perfectly clear.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't specifically change the intent.
Correct.
That was implied, but it just maybe clarifies things a little bit more clear. So, but then you said that maybe the sponsor would prefer one over the other, maybe the CS or the original version of the bill, but then I would imagine that the sponsor had enough support behind the bill to not do the CS. Just wanted to clarify it, and I know Representative Dahlstrom pretty well, to think that at least well enough, I believe, to think that she will try and do what she can to make it as clear as she can, but probably doesn't have a problem with it. No?
Through the chair, you're right, she doesn't have a problem with it, but she did not want people to misunderstand what the bill was doing. But if Representative Ledoux's idea goes forward, she will be, I don't know that she would have a problem with it.
Representative Gatto, or Representative Newman,
and
then Gatto and Ledoux.
I guess Representative Gatto may be able to answer this probably more than anybody, but don't all fire departments require an exam anyhow?
When I first started, I think we probably had to have some evidence of an exam. It wasn't until sometime later on we had fairly well-established annual medicals, went to the same place, almost on the same date, year after year after year. They took a testing on your lung capacity, they did your heart test, you had a couple optional tests you wanted to do, and we have therefore a long-established regimen of tests. Well, when I look at this, it says we're given a qualifying medical exam. It doesn't say with approval of the employer. It just says we're given a qualifying medical exam. So if I go to Dr. Joe and I say, I'm taking a test to be a firefighter, check me out, make sure I pass. And they do all the tests and they say, hey, you're a pretty fit, physical guy. I think you're fine. I'll give a recommendation that you're qualified. Is that sufficient? Because in the language, the way I'm reading it, I've had so much trouble with the municipality for years and years and years, whether it was retirement benefits, medical plans, as currently we have suits against them right now for diminishment of benefits for retirees. It's been a long and arduous process to simply get them to follow up with the agreements that people made when they hired on. And that's why I'm kind of looking at this language right here. I think we have met the requirements here by going to your doctor or what the first time the department gives you an exam or at least pays for the exam.
I'm going to interject at this point in time, and I believe it's the purpose of the sponsor, and I'm sure Kelly will correct me if I'm wrong, but the CS will probably garner more support as the bill moves forward. I think that was probably the intent of the clarifying language. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think that the bill has a great deal of support already for the presumption in this for these particular rescue workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the concern was we just didn't want to mislead anybody. And if this committee was set on the fact that this was not mandatory, then we wanted to make sure the committee got language that did that unequivocally. If the committee wants to keep the old bill, which we're fine with too, that's fine. But, Mr. Chairman, can I ask Representative Gatto to look, though, at of the CS, page 3, line 28? Because, Representative Gatto, it says by regulation. Did you happen to check that out? That it would say the type and extent of the medical examination that is needed to eliminate evidence? Do you think that the ones that you're talking about will do that in the end?
You know, I can only go by my experience there. It wasn't regulation. It was very specific which exams were done and how they were done. And we followed it as we followed a menu. So if that's not in regulation, I'd be surprised because you had to do it or you couldn't work. So it must have been in regulation, but I'm really having to second guess that.
Let me know. You want to brief these?
Do you want
to? Representative Ledoux?
You know, I think Representative Gatto makes a really good argument there. But I think what we should be deciding to do is how we want this bill to be. And yes, he makes a very good argument that could be used in a court of law that even if they don't give a specific test, that you're still under the purview of this bill and that the presumption applies. But why would you want to, since we're in the initial stages of creating the bill, we probably should spell it out exactly the way we think it should be rather than leaving any ambiguity. So that's my comment there. And then I want to ask a question. When this bill passed last year, mm-hmm. did this have a voluntary component to it?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I believe the language was the way it was in the bill before you on Friday. There was two other changes which Representative Gardner asked me about, and that was the year change and stuff, but everything else I believe was the same as what passed the House last year.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gardner?
Well, I'll confess now to being a little bit confused because if our intent, and this is what I thought the bill was for,
was to provide coverage for a list of presumptive illnesses. And if we make it optional, then we've done nothing at all. Because the biggest firefighter employer has already said the world will fall in if we do it.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a committee discussion here. I haven't been here that long. I've been here 3 years now. And what I've learned is sometimes that the sponsors of these bills know what they're doing because they spent a lot of time working on it. I'm sure Kelly probably spent a lot of time on this. But if we try and change things in the committee process without spending, Representative Dahlstrom's probably spent many, many hours and talked with many, many people on this to build this bill. I know she's been carrying it for a couple of years. And I'm very cautious to say that a committee has looked at this for a limited amount of time to make substantive changes, but I like to kind of stay with the sponsor and what they do on this.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's important to remember this bill really addresses work comp. If indeed you suffer a work comp injury, it's very difficult to actually try or want to even deny an injured person. And on the fire department, a lot of the work comp injuries, you fall off a ladder, you get a burn on your ear, you sprain your wrist or so, they're pretty easy to tell. This one is for the long-term effects, but it really is nothing more than a work comp. And I think the firefighters will probably have the statistics that firefighters, they just die early. They just do, by huge numbers of years. And the concept is, we think it's job-related. And this bill says, we don't think it anymore. We're just going to say it's job-related. And that's that presumptive clause. You can still defeat them. Say, you know, you smoked for 20 years. So now you have a lung problem. Was that caused by firefighting? Well, it's in here. The municipality, since we're naming them over and over again, is definitely protected, which they want to be. But like I said earlier, the municipality is not famous for doing right by their employees. And I think the employees, the firefighters in this case, are here for a reason. And they're asking for some help. And I think they're right.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I want to give them the help that I think that they deserve. And I'm afraid that either of these two versions of the bill have a hole so big that you could drive a fire truck through it.
A ladder truck.
Ladder? Is that a ladder truck? Or
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, would it be okay with you if what we do, if the committee desires to pass even the original bill out, that I work with the chairman of the next committee to make sure that that is taken
absolutely
care of. Also,
absolutely,
I would be more than happy to look in Representative Gatto's issue of the regulations and figure out how that all falls with the testing and see if we can come to some conclusion. I think we can. But I will gladly address those issues. Absolutely.
Representative Newman.
Sure. And I like the fact that Representative Dahlstrom, because I did ask some questions that there was a CS done too, and I think, you know, just probably not just me, but other members of the body had questions, and that's why she submitted the CS, and it's upon her request. I would like to just honor her request on that and propose the CS, but that's up to the chair.
Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the committee, and you'd like to do what?
I'd like to make a motion to adopt the CS for House Bill 200, version 25, LS0748/C for committee discussion. Make a motion to adopt.
I want to object to the CS.
Object. Call for the vote, please.
I don't care.
Yes.
Pass. I don't know the difference.
I object also. That means
no.
No. Okay.
Yes.
Representative Luke is not present. Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Hinman?
Yes.
Chairman Olson?
Yes.
Representative Gatto?
No.
3 yeas, 3 nays.
Yes.
So we're back to the original.
Back to the original.
Back to the original. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, but I do have some testimony. And that is, in my early years in the fire department, we seemed to be visiting retired firefighters in their homes on respirators who were making, I don't know, living in a kind of a cheapened trailer, trying to get by on retirement money and getting not much help. And that's why, you know, those memories are vivid. And we always said we need to do something in our retirement plan to help these guys. And we never could, because we needed the approval of the department to give away money that we had in our retirement account. They wouldn't accept it. And quite frankly, I think it's time to make up for those days. And that's why I'm a supporter of this bill.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm also a supporter of this bill, but the thing is, I'm troubled by the ambiguity about whether it's mandatory or not. And my hope is that by the time this bill comes to the House floor, it's very clear that our intent is to consider the diseases listed here as to be, well, to have the presumption that they're work-related, and that we are intending to provide coverage for those.
Representative Ledoux.
I agree with Representative Dahlstrom, and I hope Representative Gardner, and I'm hoping to see you and Representative Dahlstrom work to tighten up this language so that a municipality cannot get out of providing the coverage simply because they decide not to give the examination. I think that that would be...
Make the exam mandatory.
make either the exam mandatory, or if they decide not to give the exam, then it's their tough luck, that they have the option of giving the exam.
It counts as if they gave it.
Through the chair, to all of you, I promise to take it back to the sponsor and see what we can work on and bring it to Representative Ramis and Judiciary.
So what are the wishes of the committee? You know, I feel that the sponsors acted in good faith in bringing us a CS that failed, but I will entertain the wishes of the committee.
Move.
Representative Ledoux.
You want to do it?
I'll move House Bill 200, Version A, from committee with individual recommendations, physical notes, and just that's it, unless it was amended.
No. Opposed? Call for the vote, please.
Somebody object?
Yeah, me.
Yes.
Representative Ramis?
I pass.
Representative Gatto?
Yes.
Representative Newman?
Yes.
Representative Booth is not present. Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Chairman Olson?
No.
Representative Ramis?
Support the CS?
No.
Yes.
4 yeas, 2 nays.
That's enough.
And it's my understanding that the sponsor will be working with Representative Ramers. And
yes,
again,
sir.
Please convey to the sponsor that I supported your efforts on the CS meeting. Did a good job
gladly.
On it.
And Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Newman.
If I may make a comment, too. I supported the CS because of the clarification in there, but I didn't want to see this bill stop right here.
Thank you.
And that's why I voted yes.
Nobody to leave. With that, we'll
adjourn.
Move the bill on to the next committee, and we will adjourn at 4:32.
Set judiciary.